I'm just going to start by by way of introducing the topic, just say a few words about trousers, and then I'm going to move on to think about wolf and clothing, specifically wolf and trousers. So, from Joan of Arc to George Sand, from Mary Edward Walker to Marlene Dietrich, and from Colette to Chanel, trouser-wearing women have been associated with transgressive acts of protest and play. Although women in some Eastern cultures have worn trousers for centuries, the history of trouser-wearing women in the West is one vexed by controversy. Linked with periods of social and physical upheaval, women's liberation, radical thought, aesthetic innovation and erotic freedom, women in trousers have historically represented an illegitimate assumption of male authority and power of wearing trousers that destabilises fixed notions of sexual difference and threatens the ideology of the separate spheres. As has been well documented, in Western society, dress and clothing have traditionally worked to articulate the gendered body by making sexual difference culturally legible. And trousers, in particular, have played a significant role in the naturalisation of the sex-gender system, one that's symbolised most readily by the image of the trousered or skirted body on toilet doors. But they've also played a vital role in exposing the fragility of this schema. Referred to repressively in the 18th and 19th century as inexpressibles, ineffables, unmentionables and inexplicables, the tricky, paradoxical nature of trousers as a social garment and cultural signifier is evident in the fact that each of its names refers to the difficulty of naming and describing it. So trousers are inexpressible, ineffable, unmentionable and inexplicable. These words describe their taboo status, the shift from being adjectives to nouns themselves. What starts off as a property of trousers, as a cultural signifier, moves to become the thing itself. So trousers become inexpressibility, ineffability and inexplicability. And this anticipates, of course, the move from the bloomer as a garment of dress reform to the description of women dress reformers as bloomers in the 19th century. And so if theorists such as Roland Barthes and Alison Lurie have argued fashion and clothing are kinds of languages, then trousers may seem to represent a kind of aporia in this signifying system. Moreover, trouser-wearing women articulate a double conundrum in their transgression of proper linguistic and social codes. Named variously as hysterical, criminal, blasphemous and immoral, they've been subjected to medical, legal, religious and cultural modes of control and regulation. For in spite of the suggestion that trousers withhold meaning, that they are inexpressible or inexplicable, scarcely has any garment been subject to such sustained moods to fix and impose meanings upon it. So trousers raise particular questions about authorship and authority and acts of naming. Writing in 1899, for example, the French author Jean Grandcotter proposed in La Femme en Culotte that trousers were the living expression of authority, and that such a god has been made of trousers that woman, in her turn, would dearly love to get a better grasp of this god. So trousers become here almost a graven image, but one that nonetheless signals their status as an avatar of patriarchal and paternalistic power and authority. It's only in the past century that trousers have become a more commonplace part of Western women's attire. And although women wore loose trousers in utopian socialist communities in France and America in the early decades of the 19th century, they secured a more prominent and disquieting, famously, place in the popular imagination with the appearance of the bloomer costume, proposed by the American women's rights activist and dress reformer Amelia Jenks Bloomer in The Lily in 1851. This is actually a reprint of the engraving of herself that she published in The Lily in the Illustrated London News. Promoted by dress reformers and the hygiene movement, the bloomer costume allowed women a greater degree of physical movement, a freedom of movement that rejected the constraints of fashion exemplified by the weights of stays, petticoats, and tightly laced or otherwise corsets. So trousers became, from the 1850s, a powerful sartorial symbol for a broader project of social, political, and economic reform in the spheres of education, property, work, and suffrage, amongst others. However, if 19th century clothing naturalised sexual difference, the women's adoption of bifurcated garments was seen as an unlawful seizure of male authority and power that threatened the very fabric of the social order. Intrigue and unease about the unauthorised appropriation of this symbol of male power and privilege, especially in public, unfolds across the spaces of the streets and printed pages of the popular press on both sides of the Atlantic. And Punch offers some of the most well-known examples of that kind of mid-19th century ridiculing and anxiety about the implications of women wearing trousers. This idea that so powerful was the equation between male power and bifurcation that the unabashed and apologetic assumption of the visual symbol of male privilege was seen to be a kind of infringement of the rights of man, as well as a direct assault on masculinity. And as you can see from this example, strong-minded female said to Alfred, "Now do pray, Alfred, put down that foolish novel and do something rational. Go and play something on the piano. You never practice now you're married." And this kind of anxiety tends to pivot around a dynamic tension between rationality and irrationality. And Ian Charles took on the name Rationals as well as part of the reform movement. In spite of the cultural disquiet caused by the visible appearance in public space, trousers have played a vital role in the development and expansion of women's professional opportunities. Although not deemed to be respectable for Victorian middle-class women, they were worn by working-class women, most famously the women Pitbrow Girls, as well as actresses and music hall performers. And also prostitutes who wore trousers. Some of the kinds of anxieties about trousers in public space often hark back to a kind of anxiety about immorality or sexual impropriety. They facilitated too the professional aspirations of artists, and I suppose that's what I'm particularly concerned with today. For example, the animal painter Rosa Bonheur, who was famously given a permit allowing her to wear trousers in Paris for professional reasons, namely to visit slaughterhouses, even though it had been prohibited by law under Napoleon since 1800. And this has been quite a famous case. The law was relaxed in 1892 to allow women to wear trousers if they were holding the reins of a horse, and then in 1909 to allow women riding or holding the handlebars of a bicycle to don the forbidden garment. And you probably saw last year that the law was only formally repealed in 2013, although obviously not implemented. And Gilbert and Gubar talk about Bonheur's trousers in terms of kind of metaphorical trousers of writers like George Eliot and George Sand, who also did wear trousers as well. It's in the 20th century, though, that trousers become a more visible part of women's dress. And Elizabeth Wilson writes, "It's possible that the advance of the trouser for women is the most significant fashion change of the 20th century. For centuries, Western women's legs have been concealed, trousers and pantaloons only worn by actresses, acrobats, and others of dubious morality. And so while the fashion innovations of Paul Poirier and Coco Chanel, for example, brought trousers into the public eye, the world wars meant that women needed to wear the trousers, both in terms of wearing their husband's clothing, but also taking up traditionally male modes of labour." Trousers and trouser wearing played a vital role too in modernist women's explorations of the relationship between gender, sexuality and costuming, both in terms of artistic experimentation, but also in the crafting of professional identities as writers and artists. Rita Sackville-West, for example, says that wearing clothes like the women on the land were wearing sent her into wild spirits. "I ran, I shouted, I jumped, I climbed, I vaulted over gates. I felt like a schoolboy let out on a holiday." And in fashioning sapphism, Laura Doane cites artist Gluck's letter to her brother in 1918, where she explains that she had invented her own version of trousers, and she says, "I'm flourishing the new garb, intensely exciting. It was an experiment, and I'm glad it turned out so well." Meanwhile, Julia Kristeva notes that Colette, whose enactment of a lesbian love scene with the trouser clad Marquise de Belleboeuf in 1907 caused a near riot in the Moulin Rouge, enjoyed the nickname Colette Culotte. Trouser bodies also find diverse and divergent articulations in literary and artistic works of the period, and texts ranging from Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness to Juno Barnes' Nightwood to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, as well as the sort of self-portraiture of people like Romaine Brooks, Frida Kahlo and Claude Cahun, to name just a few examples. The transgressive potential of trousers embodied on the silver screen by Marlene Dietrich and this kind of professional trousered identity also commands the attention of modernist writers. In her letter from Paris, Janet Flanner makes note of how in 1933, and this is as a result of the prohibition on women wearing trousers in Paris, Marlene Dietrich's Paris visit, which began with the prefect of police asking her to leave town in trousers, is ending with her being asked everywhere in skirts. So even in kind of H.D. and Breyer's letters to one another, you find several allusions to Marlene Dietrich's trouser act, and but here, "Hello, Cap, did you see Marlene Dietrich's hit Paris in trousers? It's causing great excitement. I wonder if you'll come home wearing them. I shouldn't blink or flinch. They'd look very nice." And I think something like as well, the characterisation of Robin Vogt in Nightwood also draws on the kind of visual qualities of Dietrich's kind of film and style as well. Although trouser-wearing women carried strong associations with female homosexuality throughout the 1920s and 1930s, I've missed it a bit, sorry, the image of the androgynous cross-dressed trouser-wearing women is perhaps most readily associated with the lesbian look of the 1920s. Shari Benstock, for example, argues that in Women of the Left Bank, the most pervasive image of lesbianism in these years is of women who appear at first glance to be male, Radcliffe Hall, Romaine Brooks, or the Marquise de Bellevue, monocle, tuxedoed, hair cropped short, cigarette in hand. Actually, and not always wearing trousers in these instances. And that's a quotation. Although trouser wearing carried a strong association with female homosexuality throughout the 1920s and 1930s, Laura Doane has warned against the stable reading of the figure of the cross-dressed woman, and she challenges Ben Stock specifically on this. Foregrounding instead the multiple routes of passing, characterising the sartorial coding of the modern woman, Doane proposes that images of the cross-dressed woman, or rather the woman who appeared to be cross-dressed, did not register one stable spectatorial effect. And she's concerned with precisely that, the idea of the kind of boyish female body that we've already discussed, and the different kind of mannish woman or boyish girl fashions that were also being worn by heterosexual women. And Doane also highlights the importance of national difference here, you know, the difference of wearing trousers in Paris when it's illegal compared with, say, in London. So trousers, she argues, are still associated with fashion, with sports, and with that kind of fashionable boyish femininity. Marjorie Garber has famously cautioned that vestimentary codes, clothing as a system of signification, speak in a number of registers: class, gender, sexuality, erotic style. Part of the problem and part of the pleasure and danger of decoding is in determining which set of references in play in each scenario. It seems particularly pertinent to the kind of slippery meanings attached to trousers. So it's with Garber's point in mind that I turn to the intriguing and rather indeterminate place that trousers inhabit in Woolf's writing, focusing in particular on how they figure in a broader exploration of the work of the one writer, kind of as I go. So I'll begin by thinking just a bit about Woolf's interest in clothing and the relationship between clothes and writing to provide a context for the main part of my discussion, which will be the particular meanings attached to trousers in her work. In a diary entry on the 14th of May 1925, Woolf writes, "But I must remember to write about my clothes next time I have an impulse to write. My love of clothes interests me profoundly, only it is not love, and what it is I must discover." And it's this idea of the impulse to write and clothing that I want to keep in mind here. The clothing fashion, a site of ambivalent fascination for Woolf, has been well remarked by scholars. Critics such as Jane Garrity, Lisa Cohen and R.S. Coppin, for example, have carefully anatomised the complex ways in which garments and other sartorial threads are woven throughout her work, and something Deacon's been working on as well. According to Coppin, in Virginia Woolf's Fashion and Literary Modernity, Woolf thinks through clothes, presenting sartorial items as objects of the everyday, the phenomenal world that are particularly suited not only to investigations of modern relations between subject and object, but to the experience of a modern materialism, imbued with the potential of alternative realities, and the existence of other worlds. Certainly, Woolf's writing is shot through with references to various garments, and obvious ones being things like Miss Kilman's petticoats, Mrs. Dalloway, Mrs. Ramsay's glove, Mrs. Lighthouse, and Jacob's shoes in Jacob's room. But observations about fashion and dress also pepper her letters and diaries, where we find an insistent iteration of Woolf's own anxieties about purchasing clothes and her awkwardness about getting dressed, her famous clothes consciousness. In her essay on Woolf and fashion, Jane Garrity writes that although Woolf is not known for her sense of fashion, she's preoccupied with the eternal and insoluble question of clothes precisely because they are objects of perpetual invention. To the extent that clothing makes explicit the notion of personal identity as a malleable entity, it functions for Woolf as a sign, however ambivalent, of modernity. And Garrity goes on to draw out particular tension in the question of what clothing means to Woolf, arguing that, quote, "while she loves clothes, she dislikes being seen." And this question of visibility and invisibility, again, is going to be important in my discussion. And it may be for this reason, this anxiety about being seen, that Woolf's preoccupation with garments is often articulated in tension with a concern and worry about acts of dressing and undressing. She claims, for example, in a letter to Lady Robert Cecil in May 1908, "half my life is blighted by the necessity of dressing. All my friendships suffer, some die." And again, this dressing and undressing tension is something I'll return to shortly. Woolf's ambivalence about fashion is glimpsed in her famously fraught relationship with British Vogue, for which she contributed several items under Dorothy Todd's editorship between 1924 and 1926. A venue for writers such as Woolf herself, Peter Sackville West, Dorothy Richardson, Sylvia Townsend Warner, and Aldous Huxley, Vogue installed a dynamic connection between fashion and high culture that foregrounded the interrelationship between intellectual and sartorial styling, and it did so within the context of commercial consumer culture. The articles that Wolf contributed to the magazine were notably on writerly and literary topics rather than subjects of fashion and women's beauty. So I think Vogue plays quite an important role in the construction of Wolf as a professional writer, one who's moving between a kind of writing as profession and writing as art, and the kind of divisions, distinctions that you might see between those two types of writing. This is a very hopefully well-known photo of Wolf. In May 1924, a photograph of Wolf taken by Maurice Beck and Helen McGregor appeared in Vogue to accompany her nomination for the magazine's Hall of Fame. In it, the writer appeared in her mother's dark Victorian dress. And as we can see then, Wolf is very conspicuously dressed here in a way that's incongruous with her positioning as a modern writer. Not least because she's self-styled to evoke a past moment when women's physical and social mobility, as well as their professional identities and mobilities, were more restricted. In another article on Wolf and fashion, in particular on Wolf's intellectual harlotry and Vogue, Jane Garrity proposes that by identifying her with the angelic image of her mother's face, this photograph constructs an image of Wolf that, quote, draws on the conventions of Victorian womanhood. In so doing, she suggests, it illuminates the tension between the magazine's celebration of women's artistic agency, of Wolf the woman writer, with an idealised image of Victorian maternal femininity. And Garrity makes reference here to the way in which Vogue kind of persistently makes references to Wolf's genius here, so this kind of idea of the woman writer. So this tension sets in play what Garrity describes as a kind of dynamic between Wolf's looks and Wolf's books. So the photograph, as Garrity acknowledges, resists a straightforward reading. Although Garrity does say that the kind of strong maternal resonance of Wolf's pose here works against a reading of the photograph's subversive potential. What I want to suggest, though, is that if we focus less on Wolf's pose and more on the garment itself, we might be able to loosen that reading a little bit. Inhabited by Wolf, one of the great moderns, the ghostly maternal vestment gestures too to an absent, to the absent maternal body, and to the past. So by wearing the mother's dress, Wolf displaces emphasis on the garment and away from her body. So the dress here defamiliarises and estranges in a way that sets up a dialogue between body and garment, subject and object, past and present. So there's a kind of more citational use of fashion here, a staging kind of dress narrative that I think potentially emphasises or gives space for thinking about change. Certainly, Wolf's fraught relationship with Vogue illuminates something for thinking about the work of the woman writer. And I suppose this is the kind of point that I'm slowly moving towards. This is present most notably in her wrangling with the American essayist Logan Pearsall Smith, who challenged her on, quote, the ethics of writing articles at high rates for fashion papers like Vogue, because it demeans one, he said. And this is Wolf writing a letter in January 1925. Addressing Pearsall Smith directly, though, in a letter just a few days later, she defends writing for Vogue on the grounds that Todd lets you write what you like, and it's your own fault if you conform to the stays and the petticoats. In part indicating Wolf's departure from the more feminised subject of fashion pieces that she wrote for Vogue, this allusion to constrictive women's undergarments associated particularly with the restricted mobility of Victorian women, is also suggestive when it's read in light of the Vogue photograph in which she appeared in Victorian dress. So it sets up then this tension between, you know, what's underneath and what's showing on the outside, the interior, the exterior, and the way in which kind of clothes might be layered to conceal or disclose something about the body. So it illuminates something of Wolf's thinking about the work of writing and of the writing's subject through clothing. Indeed, throughout her fiction, diaries and letters, Wolf is writing in and through sartorial metaphor. Again and again, the question of the work of writing and dressing are intertwined. She describes herself in a 1918 letter, for example, as, quote, a wretched, ill-dressed, ink-stained suburban, drawing an intimate connection between the ways in which clothing and ink are similarly worn by the writing subject. And in a diary entry in 1921, she writes, more and more do I become in a state of undress. I believe this affects my writing, or it's the other way about. So writing and clothing, again and again, are implicated in this kind of mutual relationship of doing and undoing. In modern fiction, too, Wolf uses a discourse of textiles, of text and texture, to draw a distinction between the old-fashioned materialism of Edwardian writers such as H.G. Wells and Arnold Bennett and John Goldsworthy, whose work is, quote, concerned not with the spirit but with the body. And she compares this with the more spiritual and modern writing of her contemporaries, most notably Joyce. For these writers, she suggests, so much of the enormous labour of proving the solidity, the likeness to life of the story is not merely labour thrown away, but labour misplaced to the extent of obscuring and blotting out the light of the conception. The material investment in what she calls the solidity of the fabric, she proposes, inevitably confines and constrains the writer's creative vision, for, quote, whether we call it life or spirit, truth or reality, this, the essential thing, has moved off or on and refuses to be contained any longer in such ill-fitting vestments. So it's not constrained by those stays and petticoats again. Eschewing the solidity of the fabric, Wolfe is concerned instead with its diaphanous, mobile qualities, the ways in which its warp and weft, its movements and contours might enable thinking about subjectivity in ways that construe the complex relationship between inside and outside, subject and object, the seen and the unseen, corporeality and consciousness. And in particular, clothing offers a rich vocabulary for Wolfe's exploration of interiority, in works such as Mrs. Dalloway and more explicitly in The New Dress, for example. And in her article on Wolfe's, what she calls Wolfe's frock consciousness, which is quoting Wolfe, and the language of fashion, Lisa Cohen argues that Wolfe was, quote, fascinated by clothing and its effects on consciousness, or on the relationship between clothing and character, and uses frocks not to represent character itself, but to think about the modernist problem of how to represent character. And what follows this paper, I wish to move away from a focus on frocks and frock consciousness, to explore instead the ways in which trousers are worn in Wolfe's writing. I want to explore, in other words, the particularities or possibilities of what might be called a kind of trouser consciousness. It seems to me quite impossible to wear trousers, writes Virginia Woolf in a letter to Margaret Llewellyn Davis in 1917. The younger generation, she observes, walk across the downs in brown corduroy trousers, blue shirts, grey socks and no hats on their heads, which are cropped. So as I sit on the terrace, I really don't know Barbara Harles from Nick Vaganol. It may have seemed to Wolfe impossible to wear trousers, but this controversial garment inhabits a fascinating place in her writing. It figures most conspicuously and famously, of course, in Orlando, the mock biography Wolfe dedicated to Vita Sackville-West, whose seductive appearance in flats is documented in both her diaries and her letters. She also opens her essay Reviewing, published in 1939, with an image of women sitting in a shop window, putting invisible stitches into moth-eaten trousers, to illuminate the situation of poets, playwrights and novelists under the gaze of a reviewer. It is, however, to Wolfe's letters, and actually particularly her early letters, that I wish to turn now, where trousers appear as a site of ambiguity and anxiety that is peculiarly entwined with the work of writing, especially at the end of the 19th century, so at a time when Wolfe's exploring her writing identity. In a letter addressed to her cousin-in-law Emma Vaughan, whom she refers to using the nickname Toad, in April 1899, Wolfe writes, I had a vision today. Jack Hills is here for Sunday. We were sitting in the drawing room after lunch. Suddenly I looked up and saw Nessa sitting, writing, in her trousers. My feelings you may imagine. She'd forgotten her safety pin and her skirt had all come undone, and this was the result. I laughed so much that I could not say what was the matter. Jack discreetly looked the other way and Nessa went behind the screen. This is the sort of thing I have to write to you about. There's nothing else to do. In the first instance, this moment of inadvertent undressing, the undoing of Vanessa's skirt to reveal her trousers, which have been worn here as divided undergarments, really, or drawers, might be interpreted in terms of Wolfe's disquiet about female bodily display in the patriarchal Victorian household that she describes in A Sketch of the Past. And I think in a household in which the female body is vulnerable to both sexual and social pressures. We might read here, then, a displaced anxiety about her own undressing. For Wolfe, underwear in particular is associated with uncomfortable visibility. In Am I a Snob, Wolfe talks about her dislike of buying clothes, and especially underwear, what she calls her suspenders complex, because it requires visiting, quote, the most private room in the heart of a shop. You must stand in your chemise. And this last part of the sentence, you must stand in your chemise, was originally written as where you must undress. But I want to linger here on the resonances attached to the revelation or the unveiling of Nessa's trousers, her unmentionables, garments which have a particular relation to questions of visibility, and also of the ability of language to disclose meaning, in particular to disclose the meanings attached to the body. In this vision, the spectacle of Vanessa writing in her trousers is cause for not only exclamation, but explanation. Wolf suggests that this incident is simply a brief cause of, well, initially suggests that this incident is simply a brief cause of surprise, mirth, and embarrassment for the various parties involved, the retelling of which is nothing more than an either way of filling a letter in the absence of anything else to do. Writing about trousers, she claims, is the sort of thing she has to write about. Clothes seem to be posited here as little more than vain trifles, to use a famous phrase from Orlando. But perhaps this is something of a disingenuous move. In Wolf's vision of Nessa, the acts of writing and wearing trousers, she sees Vanessa sitting, writing in her trousers, are intertwined, which in turn leads to this strange loss of composure. Wolf is left speechless by the sight of Vanessa's unmentionables. She's unable to say what was the matter. Trousers become, once again, inexpressible. It may be, then, that this connection between writing and trousers is not simply the sort of thing that Wolf has to write about, but rather the sort of thing that she has to write about. Writing about trousers, in other words, is a compulsion. Wolf redresses her loss of composure through this compulsive act of composition. In this instance, then, it is Vanessa's state of undress that affects Wolf's writing. But at the very same time, in the act of composing the letter, Wolf's writing also undresses her sister. Drawing on a Bartesian notion of realist narrative as striptease and undressing or unveiling of meaning, Peter Brooks explores in Bodywork how modern narrative is concerned with undressing and unveiling the body, most particularly the female body, as an object of a male erotic gaze. And it's kind of undressing and unveiling the body as the locus of some kind of narrative truth. He argues that, quote, scenes of undressing are particularly pertinent to narratives of the body as moments of revelation and recognition. The desire to see and know the predominantly female body is stalled in modern narratives and realist narratives particularly through the attention that's paid to its clothing and accessories in the act of undressing it. And Brooks argues that this mirrors a realist plot dynamic, a movement of disclosure towards an end. And Brooks is particularly concerned with the body that's marked by sexual difference as a kind of essential definition of the body in the realist tradition. So he argues that the androgynous potential of bodies is repressed in this region. So to return to Wolf's vision, and I think this term is important, it seems that her vision works against this divestment of the female body. Her writing undresses the body of her sister, but moves quickly to redress and reveil it as Vanessa sits behind a screen. Also, by undressing Vanessa only to her trousers, she refuses to settle the matter of the truth beneath Vanessa's skirt. Now, the extent to which this incident preoccupies Wolf is apparent in subsequent correspondence, as well as, I suppose, the way in which her vision resists undressing the female subject. This is reflected in her next recorded letter to Emma Vaughan, dated 20th of April, 1899. It reads, "My dearest Hode, this is only to tell you that my dearly beloved brother is now convalescent, so be. Indeed, he is to sit up for a short time today and is allowed mutton chops and beer without stint. We shall all return on Wednesday, O most blessed day, double blessed, though I regret to say the anniversary is forgotten by us. I have bought myself a box of nibs, broad and vulgar, but more suited to the eyes of creatures that inhabit swamps. The garment in which Vanessa was left sitting was her trousers. Trousers, trousers, trousers. Now, do the obtuse beast understand?" So the garment in which Vanessa was left sitting is her trousers. And this time, Wolf absolutely has to write about trousers in a move that foregrounds interrelationship between sartorial and literary stylings. Here, however, she moves from writing about trousers to writing trousers, the word trousers. A compulsive writing of the word trousers again and again and again and again. It's almost a kind of traumatic symptom. The insistent use of the colon suggests the proliferation of trousers then, as they appear and reappear in defamiliarized forms, in capital letters, then in Greek lettering, and then repeated in lowercase. The kind of slipperiness of this has been evidence to me in trying to get this font to stay still. So, here, compulsion has become an impulsion, a movement forwards, a scriptural mobility. Far from unmentionable, Wolf's text insists on the mention of trousers, a garment that seems to at once withhold and proliferate meaning. Breaking in her new nib by writing trousers, Wolf not only provides a visual image of Vanessa's mobile identity, but furnishes the woman writer with a possible, if ambivalent, new way of writing, signified by the various shapes, meanings, and movements proliferating from the word trousers, let's say, as opposed to the stays in the petticoats. So trousers become not a site of undressing, divestment, but rather of reinvestment. They retain subsequent to these very early letters, an ambivalent state of the North's writing. And there's obviously been a lot of work on Orlando and trousers. I want to turn, though, to another somewhat lesser known but equally close-conscious text, Wolfe's theatrical farce, Crushwater. Based on the life of Wolfe's great aunt Julia Margaret Cameron, Victorian photographer, Freshwater includes also amongst its cast Julia's husband Charles Cameron, Alfred Tennyson, Queen Victoria, George Frederick Watts, and his wife, the Shakespearean actress Ellen Terry, Mary Magdalene, and the fictional character John Craig. Although the play was written in 1923, it was not performed until 1935 in a much revised version, in which Terry takes on a more central role at Vanessa Studio in Fitzroy Street. Wolfe's satiric comedy takes as its focus the Cameron Circle and its Victorian values of idealism and authenticity, explored here in relation to a particular mode of sartorial symbolism where clothes signify emblematically and allegorically. The play is concerned with Julia Cameron's attempts to photograph Tennyson, while Watts attempts to paint Ellen, who was posing for his painting, Modesty at the Feet of Mammon. Ellen Terry is in turn frustrated by her role as muse, attempting to run away with John Craig and escape her imprisonment in the artist studio for a life of, quote, beefsteaks, beer, standing under an umbrella in the rain, waiting to go into a theatre, crowds of people, hot chestnuts, omnibuses in Bloomsbury. So her rejection, in other words, is of her status as an overdetermined, static figure in Watts' aesthetic system, the kind of movements and mobilities of Bloomsbury and modern life. In addition to Watts painting Terry, Cameron also co-opts her for her photography too. And in order to prepare Ellen Terry for her role as muse to Tennyson's poet, for a muse must have wings, Julia Cameron rummages frantically through her chest, kind of closed chest, flinging out various garments onto the floor. She finds towels, sheets, pyjamas, trousers, dressing gowns, braces, braces but no wings, trousers but no wings. What a satire upon modern life. Wings, wings, wings. What do you say, Mary? There are no wings? Then kill the turkey. So this idea of kind of dressing Ellen up in turkey wings somehow undercuts this kind of version of her as an angelic muse. So the clothes chest is represented here satirically as a kind of Victorian dressing up box filled with heavily invested sartorial symbols that can be attached to the body of the female muse to make her signify, whether this is towels, braces, trousers, or even turkey wings. Mr. Cameron, kind of observing these various items, comments, he's picking them up. Braces, kind of offering us an analysis of their kind of symbolic import. Braces, fetters that bind us to the wheel of life. What are these? He picks up the trousers. Trousers, fig leaves that conceal the truth. What is truth? So this idea then of clothing again concealing some kind of truth of the body, and in this instance, sexual difference, is attached to kind of Cameron's interpretation here. What in particular is targeted directly for his pompous, overwrought, and over-invested symbolism? He's especially concerned in the first act with wrapping Ellen in white drapes to act as veils. For he wishes to convey, he says, two contradictory ideas. One, that modesty is always veiled and that she's always naked. That's the second one. One, that modesty is always veiled, and secondly, that she's always naked. So we have again this image of the veiled female body both concealing and revealing the truth that might lie beneath. Of course, the disappointment for Watts is that when he kind of looks up in a book what this symbolism means, he realises it actually symbolises the fertility of fish. So he's kind of absolutely horrified in his disclaiming about this. Though the image does then anticipate the later image of Ellen Terry sitting siren-like on a rock in the sea, which Watts then kind of ponders in the 1935 version of the play, which is what I'm referring to, as a sign that he's even better painter than he realised, because, you know, the kind of she came to embody this kind of symbolic aspiration. In her book on Wolfe and Fashion, R.S. Coppin reads Wolfe's engagement with emblematic clothing in Freshwater in terms of Thomas Carlyle's notion of Sartor Resartus, that clothes are meaningful social symbols. He says, all visible things are emblems. What thou seest is not there on its own account. Strictly taken, is not there at all. Matter exists only spiritually, and to represent some idea, embody it forth. Hence clothes, as despicable as we think them, are so unspeakably significant. And that kind of tension between kind of the expressible and the inexpressible. Clothes, from the king's mantle downwards, are emblematic, not of want only, but of a manifold cunning victory over want. On the other hand, all emblematic things are properly clothes, thought-woven or hand-woven. Must not the imagination wear garments, visible bodies, wherein else invisible creations and inspirations of reason are, like spirits revealed, and first become all-powerful? Language is called the garment of thought. However, it should rather be, language is the flesh garment, the body of thought. I said that imagination wove this flesh garment, and does not she. For Carlyle, then, not only are all clothes symbols, but all symbols are properly clothes, kind of sartorial symptoms of spiritual meanings and connections. It's this stark sartorial symbolism that is once a sort of source of fascination and travesty in Freshwater. But what interests me in particular is a significant shift, kind of giving this kind of travesty of sartorial symbolism. What interests me is a significant shift in the play's sartorial symbolism as it's revised between the 1923 and the 1935 versions. The 1935 version is the version that's actually performed, the 1923 version, obviously the one that Wolfe starts with. In the third act of the performed 1935 version, Watts spies his wife, who has left the artist's studio and who has already suggested is sitting siren-like like a rock with her arms around John Craig. So he kind of sees her in the arms of her lover. He returns to Tennyson the Camerons, though, to declare that she is dead. She's dead, drowned to me. I was behind a rock on the beach and I saw her drown. When Ellen returns to announce her departure, John Craig, Watts cries, "Ellen, Ellen, painted, powdered, miserable girl, I could have forgiven you much, I had forgiven you, but now that I see you as you are, painted, powdered, unveiled." So there's this sense then that, you know, Terry dies the moment she ceases to kind of function in his role as modesty and muse. Freeing herself of the muse's symbolic burden, she casts off her veils here, casts off the veils of Victorian sentiment to depart a fallen woman for the freedoms of Bloomsbury. So it turns out there's no truth behind the veil, but rather the powder and paint of the fallen woman, this more mobile, resistant image of Victorian femininity. The 1923 play, however, version, unfolds rather differently. This time, Ellen is also discovered in the arms of John Craig, but she's dressed in check trousers. And this particular costume is said to reference a costume that she wore in one of her boy roles from her early days on the stage, or kind of when she was very young. So here we see Terry returned to the boy trouser roles of her earlier acting career, when she was free from this traditional immobile and static role she has to play in the artist's studio. So I'm just going to read from this kind of extract of the text. So this is Watts, his discovery. "Ellen, oh, modesty, modesty," he sinks down, covering his face with his hand. Mrs. C. "Why, it's Ellen Terry dressed up as a man. How becoming trousers are, to be sure. I've never, never seen anything so exquisite as Ellen in the arms of a youth among the raspberry canes." "In the arms of a youth, and trousers in the arms of a youth. My wife in trousers in the arms of a youth, unmaidenly, unchaste, impure, out of my sight, out of my life." Mr. Craig, the lover, comes in. Watts again. "Miserable girl, if girl I can still call you. I could have forgiven you much, but not this. Had you gone to meet him as a maiden, in a veil or dressed in white, it would have been different. But trousers, no, check trousers, no. Go then, vanish with your paramour to lead a life of corruption." "Hang it all, sir, I have a large house in Gordon Square." "What? Go then to Gordon Square. Found a society in which the sanctity of marriage vows is no longer respected, where veils are rent in trousers, check trousers." Can't even finish the sentence. "Ellen, oh, I was forgetting." She pulls a long veil out of her pocket. "Here's your veil. I intend to wear your trousers in future." I never could understand the sense of wearing veils in a climate like this. There's lots of kind of puncturing of the kind of symbolic import here. But what's interesting, I think, is this, for starters, this repetition of the word trousers. Ellen Terry in trousers, my wife in trousers, 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 the horror. A little bit like that insistent kind of repetition of trousers, 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 trousers in the letter, but I think reflects a little bit more that idea of the kind of, the idea that meaning, she talks about in modern fiction, that meaning refuses to sit in its ill-fitted, we were talking about language, I can barely articulate words, the idea that meaning refuses to kind of sit and remain in its ill-fitting vestments. So again, it's this kind of, this movement and this insistent reference. For Watts, essentially, Ellen's masculine clothing, For Watts, Ellen's masculine clothes damage and distort the truth of her femininity. Decrying her lack of ideals, imagination, and sense, the symbolic in art, quotation, of the purity, modesty, and chastity symbolised by her veil, he tells her, "Go to Bloomsbury, in that polluted atmosphere, spread your doctrines, propagate your race, wear your trousers. So it's kind of really harking back as well to those associations between women's kind of sartorial acts, but also kind of political acts of reform as well. And so off she heads to 46 Gordon Square, for there won't be no veils there, she exclaims. If, as Coffin suggests, the main target of Wolfe's satire in Freshwater is what she perceives as, quote, the previous generation's symbolic overinvestment in life in the world, its symbolism in these robes, and she's quoting Wolfe here, then in this earlier version of the play, it's the trousered woman who reinvests the aesthetic moment. In this earlier version of the play, Ellen Terry's freedom is articulated in terms of that androgynous cross-dress look that characterised the fashionable modern woman of the 1920s. So here it's the fashionable trousered woman who disrupts or corrupts the sartorial symbolism of the Cameron circle and shows clothing in its much more performative, mutable, mobile, and even capricious investments. The movement of Ellen Terry, as she heads the 46 Gordon Square, not only home of Wolfe, but also more generally of the Bloomsbury Group, might thus be read as another displaced image of Wolfe's own artistic mobility, of her own escape as a woman artist, writer, from the confinements of the Victorian aesthetic heritage. We glimpse then in the figure of Ellen Terry, the model of creative androgyny, unhindered by gendered clothing and roles, that is further explored in Orlando and Room of One's Own later in the decade. And, you know, those two texts appear between these two versions. But just to finish then, I want to consider, how do we read the abandonment of trousers in the revised version of the play? If in the 1923 version of the play, trousers furnished this rhetoric of costuming with a liberatory potential, the return to the veil as a definitional garment in the 1935 version might appear to write Ellen Terry back into a Victorian model of femininity. In the very act of unveiling, the substitution of the unveiled woman for the androgynous trouser-clad woman works to veil trousers once again, you might say, to render them inexpressible. But we might also read this rewriting, this revestment and reinvestment of Ellen Terry, as a way of illuminating the multiple shifting ways in which the Arctic subject is clothed. In a late essay on the actress, published in New Statesman and Nation in February 1941, Wolfe writes of Terry as a mobile, fluctuating figure, moving and overflowing between roles so that something of her remains unacted, so something of the actress, I suppose, remains unsaid. So we see something of this movement, this need to play new parts, this vacillation, to borrow another word from Orlando, between roles, in her transition between the two versions of the play. So this might speak more powerfully then to the idea that clothes are not, as the biographer proffers in Orlando, a symbol of something hid deep beneath, but rather an expression of the subject's multiple and multiply gendered selves. So there's echoes with Orlando here, I think, this idea as well that for Orlando, femininity becomes a position from which she can be more mobile, she can kind of dress as a man or a woman. This idea, and Rachel Borby talks about this, that because femininity is an unstable position, it's a condition of kind of putting on, taking off identities. The tricksy and paradoxical nature of trousers, they're simultaneously ineffable and excessive expressions, might work then to signify a particular way of thinking about the mobility and multiplicity of the writing subject and of language itself. We might say that the excessively expressive inexpressibility of trousers works here to signify the capacity of language to disclose meaning beyond the familiar materiality of the word garment. So in Wolfe's work, inexpressibles enjoy a dynamic, if troubling, relationship with the act of writing, one that signifies the possibilities of meanings that are unconfined by ill-fitting vestments, as well as new writerly identities that need not be confined by the literary and sartorial styling of the stays and the petticoats.